So before we start talking about this week's episodes...
Oh, good. Let's stall as long as we can.
Somebody was reminding me of something that happened many, 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 many weeks ago on Trek About. Back all the way in, like, I don't know, in 1987...
Oh, when Star Trek was on.
Yeah. We covered The Changeling and Mirror Mirror. And apparently we said at one point that, you know, because you used to have this thing about like, oh, Sulu was actually gay.
Yeah, and I was
like, no, he's not. And shut up, he's not. And we said at some point that we were going to do like a special episode of Trek About, like a, you know, 1A or something, where we have a trial to determine whether or not Sulu, the character, not George Takei, the actor, because we all know that he is very gay, that Sulu, the character, would be on trial to see if he is gay or not.
I feel like that's a very offensive concept. Now that you're, like, putting it out there just like that, that's, like, actually one of the most offensive concepts that I have ever heard.
Yeah, it kind of is, actually.
Yeah, like, is this... Especially because, you know, the character is undoubtedly gay, but that's, you know, not the point.
We were kind of dicks, like, 8 months ago.
We are kind of dicks, but yeah, I... You know something? I feel like with the Next Generation crew, we have gotten to be better people. You know, because
Just like humanity has evolved, we have evolved.
Yes.
And it didn't take us 70 years. It only took us a few months.
Here's the thing. I really don't want to have to come up with the evidence that,
And that would all be on you because you're the one who would be the, I guess, the prosecution in that.
Burden of proof. But what if you're, wait, flip it around.
Uh-huh.
Prove to me that Sulu is straight. Oh. Oh-ho.
I think, wait a second. Sulu's not gay. Sulu's not straight. Sulu is asexual.
He's a sexual guy who's really into dudes.
Okay. So we're obviously not going to do that.
Thank God.
Second piece of feedback for this week.
Oh.
Someone actually had a comment on the whole Wesley situation that we're encountering in this first season of Next Gen. And he said, and this is going to be very shocking, and let's go here. We were wondering at his purpose in the ensemble. And
Wesley's.
Right. And this guy says, maybe you already know this, but it seems obvious to me that at this point in the series, he's supposed to be secretly Picard's love child with Beverly. I can see the look on your face, but he goes on. If you view things with this in mind, it's incredibly obvious, like in Farpoint, Encountered Farpoint, when Beverly takes Wesley to the bridge and she tells Picard he's her son and Jean-Luc says, your son? Why would he be so taken aback? Because he's meeting his son for the first time. Presumably, they'd been carrying on an affair behind her husband's back, but couldn't continue after he died. So Beverly raised Wesley on her own.
Huh. You know, I don't necessarily know if it was a long-term affair. I mean, I get the sense it was more they knew each other and maybe a one-time thing that resulted in a child. But that said, you know, the basic crux of the theory that they are, you know, he's intended to be Picard's son actually thematically makes sense. That's why he lets this kid get away with so much shit. That's why, you know, no matter how many times Wesley fucks up, he's still on the ship. He's allowed to run amok through engineering.
We will talk about him running amok in this episode 11001001, which, my God, seriously, what is with this name? But yeah, I feel
if he's
like
the captain's son, yeah, then he would have those privileges.
I appreciate a good fan theory. I don't know that there's any real evidence for it one way or the other. And I haven't really ever read anything to the effect that was supposed to be the case. It makes sense from the information that we've seen so far, but I feel extremely uncomfortable with it. Nonetheless,
no, I'm actually, I like this theory a lot.
Okay, well,
and it would, I think it does give a kind of more of a reason for the awkwardness between Beverly and Picard. You know, they
so in this case, then
it kind of makes sense, yeah, why they would not actually have a relationship.
But Beverly would not have told Picard this, so I don't think that he actually knows.
Wouldn't she have told Picard this? Or maybe he kind of...
assumes?
I can see why she wouldn't necessarily want to make a big deal of it to him, because at this point, Wesley's more or less raised. You know, he's definitely going through schooling, he's going through, you know... But he, you know, she got through the, him as a baby, him through childhood, you know, all on her own. She didn't, you know, need Picard, you know, there. Certainly she's, has enough reason she's working on the ship, and certainly she is probably pleased that they have a good relationship with each other. But at the same time, I don't think she has much of a reason for, you know, making, you know, for wanting to let Picard know that, you know, you need to be dad right now, because she, you know what I mean?
No, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I just find it disturbing.
Yeah.
I won't give any information about whether or not this is confirmed or rejected in any way later on in the series, but I will say that we should try and remember to discuss this after we get to the last Next Gen movie.
Okay.
Which we probably will not.
And again, it could
because that's going to be in approximately 2045. But we can certainly try.
Listen, listeners, if we're around the time of the last Next Gen movie and we have forgotten about this conversation, please, you know, remind us. Just put a comment or send us an email or something.
So let's talk about 11001001.
Okay.
Wesley, I hear something in your voice, which I think is very interesting, but I want to pick up on the Wesley thing some more, because of course in this episode, maybe more more evidence for Wesley being Picard's love child, is that, Riker decides to leave Wesley, in charge of the ship, which seems like an extremely bad idea.
You know,
even though they're in Starbase, it still seems like an extremely bad idea to me. And it turns out pretty badly.
Well,
so yeah,
you know, these two episodes, I feel like they, and in the second episode a little more so with
Picard. Too short a season.
Yes. And in Too Short a Season a little more so with Picard. But I feel they're starting to get a better handle on who the characters are now. Because in this we kind of see, especially in the first half of the episode, the characters just kind of in relaxation mode. You know, the moment when you have Yar and, you know, and Worf are going to be playing Freezy Squares. And, you know.
Parisies.
Freezy Squares, and Yar and Riker are kind of just joking with each other, and they have just a very friendly relationship. Well,
I'm sure they fucked like off screen.
Well, you
somewhere.
Know, but that's a side of the two of them we haven't necessarily really seen much of, and I think that's a nice little moment. I like how Dr. Crusher is just geeking out about some random research project that, you know, we've never seen her being able to just do an intellectual exploration for its own sake. We've always seen, well, if she doesn't do this, people are going to die, you know. And, you know, it's nice seeing her have a sense of fun about her work.
Yeah.
I like that Picard is just going to, you know, put on some music and just read a book and, you know, hang out in his quarters, you know. And I like that. That makes it very clear who all these people are by what they're doing with their free time.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that I think that 11001001, and boy, do I have fun saying that. I don't know why I'm saying it so much, but okay. I actually really like this episode.
This is two episodes. It's a really stupid sci-fi plot and a good character episode.
I think it's, was thinking, we had been talking off mic about whether or not I would say that I would like sort of recommend any episodes in the first season, like unreservedly, like, are there good episodes of Star Trek? I kind of feel like I probably would recommend this one as a good episode of the show in general. Is it as good as the show gets? No, of course not.
Okay.
The show has many, many better episodes than this. On a list of like the best episodes of the Next Generation, this would probably not even crack the top 25 or 20 or 30. But I feel like this episode is not embarrassing. It is quite good. It moves along at a good pace. And yeah, it does have some.
I hate the Binarians.
The Binars. Yeah,
I hate them.
They're
obnoxious. They are the worst aliens we've seen.
But I think they're supposed to be obnoxious.
So that makes it okay.
Well, I think it does because you know, intent matters. And I think a large part of what's wrong with the first season of The Next Generation is that what they're intending to convey is not actually what they're intending to convey. Ferengi, perfect example.
Yeah.
They wanted the Ferengi to be this race that was going to be like the antagonist of the series, and it was going to be real, and it just didn't work. I mean, they're patently ridiculous. But I don't feel like they really had a good handle on why, and they kept trying to make the Ferengi happen until they realized that they weren't going to happen. With this episode, I feel like they knew what they were trying to do. They did it well. Everybody got some characterization. Everybody got some nice moments, except for Troy, who's not in the episode for some reason. And which, again, is weird because...
What is she doing during her week off? I want to see that.
Yeah, I don't know what she's doing. Maybe she was just in her quarters crying. I don't know. and then, of course, once that is over, because I don't think that you could sustain an entire episode of this show with just these people kind of hanging out. Yeah. It's not that kind of show.
No.
I liked watching them hang out more than I thought I would. And it's very strange because we don't really have a good handle on who these people are yet, but I think we're starting to, and I like them.
Yeah. Worf and Yar are in their free time. It says a lot that they're still doing something that's extremely competitive, that they're taking it from different angles. They are, you know, both of them are extremely physical people who are, you know, they're playing sports. That I like that. I like that you have...
And that makes sense.
Yeah. That Picard...
Also the great line that Worf is starting to develop a sense of humor. You know, like things like that, which I just like.
Yeah. It's nice seeing them kick their hair down. I loved seeing Geordi trying to teach Data to do art. And, you know, just... I love their relationship. And it's nice to see... Well, you know, they're still hanging out together after... You know, it gives the sense of a group of people who not only work well together, but like each other.
Yeah, and I don't think that we've seen that before.
Yeah. You talk about how, you know, it was mandated on the show that there was not to be any conflict between the cast and, you know, beyond, well, he's been possessed type of things. There have not been many long-term conflicts on the show. They've all been resolved quickly.
Yeah.
And this is starting to kind of justify that. In the episode with Troy's mother, you know, Picard, ordered an argument non-existent. Here, you have a group of people who like each other enough that they would, just out of respect for each other, not want to, you know, hurt each other's feelings or be very sensitive to who the other people are. Again, this is a ship with the counselor on the bridge. They all have this paramount in their minds,
which is interesting in light of Riker's characterization in this episode, because I think Riker comes across as kind of an asshole in this episode, which is a weird choice, because I think that we've certainly talked about Riker as being probably one of the more likable characters in the show at this early stage. And you know, I don't get the sense that whoever wrote this episode really watched a lot of the show for something. Like, it seems weird because, like, he has this really cutting line about, you know, a blind man teaching an android how to paint, which is like, that's just
and
weird.
And that scene is almost out of place with the rest of the, like, again, his conversation with Yar is a nice conversation. You know, they're teasing Worf slightly, but very good naturedly. You know, of course, he's fine with the captain, but, you know, with Wesley, he's like, oh, those binars are being, you know, shifty, you know. And,
yeah.
Which turns out to be, you know, correct in a way. But, the line with to Geordi and Data where he's not just amused by this painting, you know, or, you know, happy that they're having fun, you know, or that they're learning to... You know, that Data is trying to cultivate an interest in art and that he is developing friendships with the rest of the crew is extremely significant, you know, especially considering that he wants to be human. He's trying to be human in every way he can be. And, you know, that even comes to painting.
Yeah. And I find, you know, it's interesting because, you know, in a lot of ways, this episode is about personhood and sort of artificial intelligence in a way, because, you know, obviously you have Data, who we've definitely had episodes about already. And we know Data's story so far. Minuet. I mean, I think, you know, we have to talk about Minuet because...
And I will say, the entirety of every single scene in the bar, no matter who's... That was wonderful.
Yeah, like that, I think, is...
She was wonderful. I liked her. I liked their interactions with her. I liked her, yeah, that was a really cool scene.
Well, it kind of makes sense, right? Because if you think about having like the most powerful computer in the galaxy, and we learn that the Enterprise has the most powerful mobile computer in the galaxy, and it has to rescue the Binars at the end of the episode, which, okay, fine. I guess it sort of makes sense that you could have a computer like that create, I mean, you know, assuming that this is, you know, 300 years in the future, 370 years in the future, whatever it is. And they have very advanced artificial intelligence. They have very advanced sort of, you know, technology in general. And so you can have a computer that can create a person. I mean, you know, I think it's an open question whether or not Minuet is a person, and we don't really see enough of her in this episode, I think, to get a good sense of whether or not she's just a really good simaculum or not.
Well, that's the,
but here's my question. If the computer can create a sentient being, isn't the computer sentient?
I don't know necessarily, because that is a bit of a, no, the computer is not necessarily, it's not necessarily sentient. It could be, it could not be. It's, one does not have anything to do with the other. Because one would, if we agree that one could program a person, like if we take that as given.
Sure. Yeah. Then, and I think we have to, because of Data again.
Then one could assume that Data could be the part of certain automated processes coming together to let's say Data is disassembled right now. Right now he's not a person. There is not let's take the existence of a soul non-religiously for a second. You know, those lore when he is disassembled, he's not a person. He's not a person till it's put together. You could have essentially a dumb factory printing chips in a certain way that the factory would not necessarily be sentient. It would be putting together a program that, when assembled, would create enough loops in order to have create life.
I guess so, but I think my problem with that analogy.
You should read Gadel Escherbach, by the
way. I'm not going to. Maybe I will. My problem with that analogy is that, number one, the computer is not a factory, and we're not talking about physicality here. What we're talking about is a computer which is controlling, let's not forget, Minuet, and is obviously in constant communication with Minuet, because Minuet does say that she can access the data. I mean, there's that scene where Picard first walks in and she starts speaking French to him. And of course, Minuet's not a real person. She doesn't speak French, but she says that and she's aware of her artificiality. She's aware that she's not a real person in, you know, quote unquote. She can access files, and she puts it in those terms. And she talks very openly about the fact that she is a hologram. So all of those things seem to me to lead up to the fact that Minuet might actually be an extension of the computer.
Well, I mean, we've seen the computer certainly processing tasks in a natural language way on an extremely sophisticated level. The computer can do bits of analysis that computers today, it's impossible for them to. Even in original series, we've seen the computer do that. They have conversations with it. So, you know, this is one of those philosophy of AI questions that, I mean, I like that the show gives an opportunity to ask those.
Sure.
In the Big Goodbye, that's kind of one of the things that it addresses that in the same way at the end with the cop that he's, you know, friends with, you know, saying, oh, you know, do I have a wife and kids outside of there? Well, that's, I think, a very similar question to, you know, is Minuet the computer, or is she an extension of that? You know, if those wife and kids have existences, do they have separate existences? Do they have existences as extensions of the computer? Okay, well, if they have existences, then his kids have classmates. Every single one of them has a existence. Every one of those kids has a family. Every one of those families has, in other words, how deep does this rabbit hole go?
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if we know the answer to that. And I don't know that the show is necessarily interested in providing answers to those questions.
And I don't think answers to these questions can never be made, because number one, we don't have this technology yet.
Right.
this is not, this may not be something that we can answer until a couple hundred years
from now. But at the end of the day, I think that if you do have a computer with the ability to sort of like create an artificial world or an artificial environment with the ability to sort of self-generate and self-replicate,
yeah,
then I think the question may be answered.
And of course, the talking about a virtual world is talking about our own world as well. You know, if we're asking if Minuet has, again, a soul, we are really asking the question of whether we have souls.
And what does it mean that Riker can't get Minuet back at the end of the episode?
I assumed that was because, so you had these...
The Binars
kind of soup up the computer a little bit more in order to make this super realistic, the perfect woman. And it's interesting how, by the way, the last time we saw Riker playing with a holodeck, he had those little harp ladies.
Well, it wasn't holodeck, but yeah, the hologram thing quarters. Yeah.
Similar, you know,
Riker's horny.
That's probably a personal version of the holodeck in a way. You know?
Oh, sure.
It's
yeah.
The handheld version in a way.
I bet.
Hey. So yeah, Riker goes for the porn simulation, but you know, maybe the, you know, he looks for the perfect woman, and in a way she is, and because they have this computing power, once they've done their thing, I think that the computer could, you know, the computer stasis level is a little less powerful than it was. In other words, they were probably spiking it for Minuet.
Yeah.
And so I got the sense that, you know, the computer's now no longer powerful enough to make Minuet. She is an unattainable goal right now.
Yeah, and also I think there is a case to be made for the fact that, yes, number one, the Binars were obviously doing something to the Enterprise computer. Number two, you have to remember as well that they were shutting down large portions of the ship as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, the full power of the Enterprise computer, without having to worry about keeping the lights on all over the ship and all these kind of things, may be able to do something like this, but abstracted onto a larger ship, it can't do it.
When
right?
the ship's operational, yeah, that's.
And also, I mean, would you want the computer to be able to do this? Because I think that there's an argument to be made for this. Perhaps may not be morally correct.
Like, well, that's kind of one of the things that Picard suggests at the end. You know, some relationships just aren't meant to last. You know, Picard's reactions to Minuet I love, because he is at once, you know, he's incredibly charmed by her because she is incredibly charming. He is fascinated by the technology. You know, he openly says, you know, and talks to her like, I can't believe, you know, this is astounding, you know.
But notice that.
But he's also a little creeped out.
Well, that's my point. Remember, I don't think Riker ever talks to her like that. He talks to her like a person, whereas Picard is talking to her like he's interacting with a computer. And I find that interesting. And I think that speaks to, that's a very subtle character note. And I think it speaks to something that the episode maybe doesn't even realize that it's doing.
It's reminding me of a few other things. Number one, in the big goodbye, Picard does have an open conversation again with the cop partner at the end about his virtual nature. And also remember the Data Lore episode. Picard is the one who says, look, we can't talk about Data without, you know, referencing the fact that he's an android. You know, I mean, no offense.
Yeah.
He doesn't pretend that individuals who are not human are human because he does not consider being non-human to lessen who these individuals are. In a way, by pretending that Data or Minuet is human, that is denying the reality of who they are. He doesn't, you know, because Minuet is a simulation, because Data is an android, he doesn't think any less of them. That does speak a lot to who Picard is. He is going to take people at their face value.
Yeah, I think that's
right. But he also doesn't want to sugarcoat it.
I think that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you, I know you said you weren't a big fan of the Binars, but
mostly because at the end, why I didn't like them, and maybe this is a very, you know, stupid reason, because I was kind of with them until the end when they're just like, well, you didn't ask. And I'm like, fuck, you really went there. You really went there. Like, they couldn't have given a better, you know, reason for why they had to. I don't know. It just seemed stupid. It's one of those plots that's based on not having a conversation.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't necessarily dislike it. I know usually I dislike
it was,
things like
and
that.
And I agree, it was a personal, you know, if the line hadn't hit me the wrong way, I might have a different...
I think it was, you know, they tried to sort of dodge, I guess, that criticism of the episode, because I think Riker does say at the very end, after they say, well, you might have said no, so we didn't ask, which is kind of the logic of a child, honestly. also is that, like, he says that, well, they think in binary. So like, they think yes or no, right? And I don't really get the sense that the Binars have a conception of negotiation, really. Like, it's just kind of like, either you say yes or you say no, and if you say no, then we go away and we die. Like, so for me, yeah. I guess it made sense to me in that respect, because the Binars were thinking, okay, if we ask the Federation for help and they say no, then that's it. Yeah. Whereas if they say yes, great. So I guess for them, the risk was too much.
And I get that. You know, it's... I do like the episode from having, you know, talked about it. I, you know, the reasons that you like the episode, I agree, are valid. And it does have a lot of great moments. And if that was what I disliked about it...
Yeah.
You know?
I think on the whole, you know, it's a very quiet episode, and I think it's the kind of episode that the show needed at this point.
Yeah.
It shows a greater range, and I think it shows that the characters are and the actors are getting more comfortable with themselves in these roles. And the other thing I think that's really interesting about the episode is that it really ups the stakes on the special effects as well. Like, I really feel like, and this is a minor point, but I think it's worth saying that, you know, they were as good. I mean, especially on the Blu-rays, like, you probably can't really tell terrible standard definition versions, but that those special effects, I mean, they reused, I think, some of the optical effects that they used for one of the movies.
Okay.
At this point, it was probably Star Trek III or Star Trek II. And so that first appeared in one of the movies. So they were reusing that. And so all of those special effects were basically reused shots from motion pictures. So, like, they really got a good bang for their buck on this. And I think that probably was kind of mind blowing on a television, like, in 1988, to see that, you know? So I think that's really speaks to the show, like, maybe getting more comfortable with itself as well a little bit.
Yeah.
And just kind of stretching its legs and saying, yeah, we can do things like this.
And again, the scenes with Riker, Picard, and Minuet were all great. The scenes between the cast members were good. You know, I can't say I disliked the episode, and I think we are getting much better. They're starting to figure out a little bit more of the voice of the show. It's still a little old school, but a little closer.
And then it all goes to hell.
Really?
With the next episode.
Interesting.
But before we move on, we should rate this one.
I would give this 11 binary digits.
Can we give it a personal relaxation light? Because I really want to know what the fuck a personal relaxation light is. Is that a fleshlight? Is that a 24th century fleshlight?
I mean, obviously that's what a personal relaxation light is.
Okay, I don't really want to think about Riker using a fleshlight. Or Picard using a fleshlight.
Why not?
He doesn't do it for me.
Really?
He's fine. I'm not saying he's an attractive man. Huh. I just, you know, I don't really want to think about him sticking a fleshlight up his butt or whatever you do with
that. That's not what... Never mind. You know, just...
Look, I don't need to know.
You know, yeah.
I'm glad you have a fleshlight, and I'm glad you enjoy it.
I don't have a fleshlight, actually.
Okay. Well, that's enough information for our listeners. I will give this one, really, 11? You really liked it that much?
That means 2.
I get it. That's funny. You're funny.
Yeah, I'm hilarious.
I'll give this a 5. I think it's a solid episode.
I don't really know what I would rate this. Let's give it a 5.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next episode. Unfortunately, too short a season, which is not short enough for me.
I liked it.
Get out.
I liked this. I didn't love this episode. This wasn't the best episode, but I liked
this. Wasn't
this.
The best episode.
I
That's
liked
an understatement.
It, and I feel like this is a very, again, talking about characters figuring themselves out, I think this is hitting Picard's notes a little better.
Yeah, but Picard wasn't really in the episode.
He has that all.
This is my problem with this episode.
Okay,
is that
I mean, the makeup is off.
Well, the makeup is awful, but and it looks even worse in HD. But
oh God, I can only imagine. I have to see that later. I'll show you later.
My problem with Too Short a Season is that it's one of those episodes which relies on us caring about a character that we have never seen again. We have never seen and will never see again. And I don't care. Like, I really fundamentally do not care about Admiral Mark, whatever the fuck his name was. And he's an asshole. He's a jerk. Like, it's, you know, like if you had made this episode primarily about some sort of like negotiation or something, that would have been fine. But it relies on us like, because they make the episode very personal, and we've never seen this character before, and we will never see him again because he is dead. And so I don't, you know, that's not why I'm watching the show.
See,
I don't know why I'm watching it because it's first season TNG, but there we are.
Well, because a year or so ago, you're like, hey, Richard, let's watch every Star Trek ever made. And I'm like, yeah, sure.
And why did I say that?
Why did I agree?
I don't know.
See, I like to contrast characters, and I think about Captain Kirk, or Admiral Kirk. I think about Admiral.
Well, I think that that's interesting, and I do want to pick up on that because I sort of have something to say about that as well, but like, I will let you continue.
I think about Admiral Kirk, and now we talked about how the beginning, you know, Kirk at the beginning of the motion picture and Wrath of Khan is kind of, Wrath of Khan was kind of a do-over in some ways, but we have... Kirk is an admiral who takes over a ship and who goes, you know, for kind of personal, I feel very out of place, I'm getting old reasons, especially in the motion picture. He swoops and steals the command from what's his name?
Decker. Yes.
Another character we're supposed to care about that, you know, never appears anymore. His motivations and this admiral's motivations are not completely dissimilar, except this admiral crosses a line that Kirk would never cross, and I think this is one of those episodes which shows a failure in Starfleet and kind of reminds us why we have shows featuring the captains we've seen. There is a contrast to Kirk, and there is also... Picard is being contrasted against this admiral because, especially with the speeches he's making towards the end, when he is talking about the revenge is kind of useless and all of that, Picard sees a situation that just went to shit, and he's almost sees a sense of the tragedy of the situation. And I like that he recognizes that at the end. I like that he doesn't seem to... He holds the admiral and he holds the warlord both culpable for what they've done, but he also recognizes that, you know, they were part of something larger and just something shitty, that they just made some really wrong choices.
I like the episode that you were describing. Unfortunately, Too Short a Season is not that episode. I mean...
And that's fair.
For the first 25-30 minutes, it's an episode about how he keeps getting younger and he's dying and his wife is upset with him. And it's like, I don't care, dude. Like, I've never seen you before. I will never see you again. You know, they do have... This undercurrent of the episode running where they're going to this planet that is having this civil war, blah, blah, blah. There's terrorists, whatever, who really cares, hostages. And that's all fine, but the governor never comes across as a real person or a real character.
He is an original series villain.
He definitely is. And the other thing I think is problematic with this episode is that, you know, This kind of undercuts, to your point somewhat, I think this undercuts Starfleet in a large way because, you know, certainly people can make mistakes and cover things up, but I don't necessarily get a sense that this character, Jameson, I think his name was, assumedly he was a captain when he did this, would have been able to... cover this up. I mean, why wouldn't, like, the Federation wouldn't wonder why the Civil War was going on for 40 years? Like, that seems like an interminably long time for a Civil War to go on. And so
Well, I mean, the Civil War goes on so long just because you have, you know, this just seems like a society which is based on, you know, very much retribution. And so I can
see. No, I disagree with you. They explicitly say that the reason why the Civil War goes on for so long is because he armed both sides.
Yeah. And then you can see that. So he killed people from that other camp. If he had just, you know, he killed people from the other tribe or family or whatever. And if they had no weapons, they would have just, you know, now they have the guns. Well, they put an arm thing against his camp. I can see that ultimately it's two sides, just revenge killings, and suddenly you have a World War One type of
situation.
Yeah,
but see, the thing is, though, is that at least in the episode, they were saying that the Civil War was petering out at that point. And so, like, how did it start up again? Like, Starfleet didn't ask any questions? Like, it doesn't jive. Like, even if, like, Captain Jameson had falsified his logs, which he said he did at the end of the episode, to hide the fact that he had given weapons to both sides. He was there because the Civil War was about to end, and then suddenly it flares up again. How? We don't know. Starfleet doesn't ask any questions.
But that turns out that's not what happens. That's Karras or Karnas or whatever his name is lying. He finds out somehow that Admiral Jameson is still alive, and all of these years he's been distracted by the war, and...
And to be fair, I was asleep by this point in the episode, so...
You get the sense, you know, he's fighting this war peters out, things are stable, there's a Federation ambassador that's on the planet, things are going okay, the Warlord finds out, oh god, the Admiral's still alive, you know, he assumed that he would have died just because of the passage of years or something like that, finds out he's still alive, says, I need to just get my revenge on this guy, now that the war's over... I have
no. Time. What I'm saying is the war was petering out 40 years ago. So the war
was no war petering out 40 years ago. It was. I got the sense that the killing was just a, you know, random killing, you know,
I
from one
know.
Family to another. It seems like a
The episode doesn't provide us with enough information to know one way or the other. And again, I really don't understand how Starfleet could not have, like, asked any questions about this whatsoever. I mean, like,
maybe they did, but who's going to say, well, oh, you know, the only person who knows that maybe he gave them these guns in very big secret. Maybe he worked. I would assume he worked it enough that it would be untraced. It would not be traced back to him. You know, you have a planet that's at war that's not a member of the Federation. It's not like they're going to let the Federation in and, you know, let them question, oh, well, where did you get those weapons? You know, the planet can say, that's not your business. You know, this is our fight.
So why were they there in the first place then?
Why is the Federation on any planet?
I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, let's put this in historical context, right? Because they said that this war lasted for 40 years and he was sort of there 45 years ago or whatever it was. So 45 years ago from the Next Generation is about, like, let's say 20 to 25 years after the end of the Undiscovered Country. And so you've got someone in Jameson who reminded me a lot of the way that Kirk acted with the Prime Directive, where he sort of interpreted it in different ways, bended it and broke it if he wanted to.
I thought that was very significant how he said my interpretation of the Prime Directive in this case was
right.
Arming both sides would make it neutral, which is, he figures if everyone's armed, we'll be okay, and turns out to be a disastrous mistake, of course.
Which actually, if you think about it, was very similar to what happened in the original series episode of Private Little War, where Kirk very much was like, they can't have these weapons. Like, so for me, it was strange because it was kind of reminding you of a much better episode of Star Trek, even though Private Little War was not a particularly great episode in the original series. And so for me, it was weird because I'm like, okay, obviously you were setting up Jameson as someone who was, a captain in a bit more gung-ho era of the Federation and Starfleet. It was certainly not Kirk era. It was not like anything goes, I can just do whatever I want. But at the same time, and, you know, honestly, we don't really know at this point what that era of the Federation looked like. So we're sort of, you know, this is the first indication that we're getting, like, of what the Federation was like.
Here's awesome.
Kind of in that period between Kirk and Picard, right? And what the sense you get from this is, like, the Federation was getting less cool with captains just kind of doing whatever they wanted. And so they were like, no, you need to uphold the Prime Directive more. And what I get from this is Jameson realized that, but he still wanted to do what he wanted to do because he was someone who came up in Starfleet only, you know, maybe 30 years after Kirk. So he kind of still had this idea that you could do whatever you want, but he needed to hide it. And I think like what I find problematic about this is just the fact that, you know, Jameson comes across as a very like third rate Kirk in this episode.
I don't think he's supposed to be seen as a great captain.
No, I don't think he's supposed to be either.
And
but...
let me bring up a point. How do we know that nobody in the Federation besides Jameson knows that it was Jameson's fault? How do we know that there wasn't a special Federation investigator sent who found this out? But because of his, you know, the way his career is, I mean, this could have been buried.
It could have been.
But don't think it's impossible.
I wonder about that because I just fundamentally do not believe that if that were the case, that Jameson would be an admiral.
No, that is certainly a point.
Like, I feel like he would have been drummed out of the service in that respect then.
Here's
your pension, get out. Like, you know, they don't need pensions, but you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't fundamentally make any sense to me.
We could be coming up with, you know, wacky theories to explain a plot hole, and in a way we are.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's not a very well-constructed episode.
You know, I'm trying to, we see Jameson as a very proud man, as a very flawed person, and I don't think I think there are bits of his job that he is legitimately good at. The scene where when they're going through the tunnels and they're saying, oh, well, our tricorder says this, and he's like, no, we're going this way. You know, he's making decisions that everyone's disagreeing at, and they turn out to be he does lead them right to where the hostages are.
Yeah.
He's a terrible battle tech, you know, strategist. He's kind of the reason that that mission does go south. But as far as planning it, that was a good plan. If he'd had he'd been a better shot.
He's good at strategy, but not at tactics.
Yes. And for a negotiator, maybe that is a better, you know, we do get the sense he is less of an in the field, you know, he's less of a combat, you know, agent and more of a diplomatic, more of a negotiator. He knows how to read people well. I liked the scene when he was with Troy and she's, you know, saying, oh, I sense, they're talking about his reaction, and then he says, no, I know him well, and actually this is the reason that he's doing this. And
Troy's like, oh yeah, okay, maybe.
Yeah, and of course we do, you know that his reaction is a little more deep than that, but he does recognize a lot of, he does seem to read certain people very well, at least that he knows well.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that Jameson is supposed to be a complete incompetent. I don't think he gets to be a Starfleet admiral being a complete incompetent.
He's flawed in a lot of ways. He's, you know, what his wife says, you know, you always assume that what you want is what everybody else wants. I think that's the keynote to his character. He knows in a lot of ways that he's extraordinarily competent, and maybe he doesn't notice the ways in which he's flawed, or maybe he does figure that he's...
Well, I guess, okay, so...
He figures he's untouchable, you know?
Well, I think that's interesting, because I think in a lot of respects, then, he may be Kirk without the self-awareness. Because the thing about Kirk was always that he knew that he was extraordinarily competent, and he knew that he was extraordinarily gifted in some respects, but he also was willing to listen to Spock and to McCoy, and he knew when he was wrong.
Well, that's it. He surrounds himself with people who are keeping him sane. Kirk does.
Yeah, I guess you can get the sense that Jameson's first officer was not exactly, I mean, he was probably milquetoast, right?
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't a strong character. He wasn't a strong man or woman. So,
you know,
that could be that.
I think it's interesting when, you know, his wife is saying, oh, you know, family quarters here. If, you know, we'd been on the ship, we would have, you know, been together for a lot longer. You know, you get the sense that he is, you know, she is the kind of person, if he would listen to his wife, he would have saved himself a lot of trouble. She is very practical, very down to earth, she is his moral center.
I liked her.
Yes, very much.
I thought she was a great character.
Yeah.
You know, and we don't get to see a lot of her, but from the little we see, she's extraordinarily, she's a great,
I like that she doesn't suffer fools and she doesn't take bullshit. She,
yeah.
You know, she makes it very clear the entire episode, you know, no, she loves him. She's there for him. But she's hurt and angry that he kept stuff from her. You know, she is much more upset about that than, you know, if he had come and said, here's what I'm thinking of doing, she wouldn't have been as upset. And I think, you know, I think there is a sense that, you know, maybe if she had been with him all of those years, you know, anytime he came back from, you know, he probably may have said to her, look, here's what I'm thinking of doing. Here's what I think of the Prime Directive. And maybe she, you know, she probably would have said, look, that's a really stupid idea. You know, it's just going to lead to everybody killing each other. You know, maybe she would have an idea. He needed a person to externalize his thoughts. Kirk succeeds because he is able to trust McCoy and Spock with his thoughts, with his thought process. He is able to take, and I think that's part of the reason that we see Picard being a successful captain, because, I mean, he has a much larger group of people to draw from, and he explicitly asks them, again, anytime he's in the conference room, he makes sure that every single person in this, he doesn't let somebody not have an opinion in that room, you know?
Yeah.
He, you know, anytime somebody doesn't have, he's like, no, give me something, you know, tell me something, you know, maybe, you know, Dr. Crusher, it may be early, but I have to know something, you know, I can't decide if he's has these people positioned exactly because he knows they may be better at some things than he is. His job is synthesizing everybody else's thing. Kirk was a different captain in that way. Kirk
very much was top down, and I think he was very much someone who was keeping a lot of information away from people unless they absolutely needed it. And so he had his confidants, and that's all he needed. Whereas Picard is more of the kind of the leader of an entire crew, and he's just a different kind of captain. He wants openness, he wants transparency in the way that Kirk did not want.
Again, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are one character.
Picard,
Troy, Data, they're not one character. This is a group as opposed to a synthesis of a psyche.
What do you make about Picard going down on his first away mission?
Hasn't been his first away mission. He has been off the plane off once or
off
twice.
Off the plane?
Shut up. Wasn't he down in Farpoint?
No, I don't think he did. He didn't go down. Riker actually stopped him from going down.
There was one moment I felt like there was, but either way, it's super exciting when he goes down on a mission because
he went down on the
racist
code
one.
Of honor.
Yeah,
he did. Yeah, but that wasn't really an away mission.
Still, whenever he goes off the plane, it's damn it.
Hear that, folks? It's not a starship. It's a plane. It's the USS Enterprise. It's a plane.
Whenever Picard's going off the ship, it's a very significant...
The plane, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Whenever Picard's going off the tugboat, it's a very significant moment. And so I did like, oh, shit, he's going! You know, I did like that scene. I liked...
I liked it because, like, I think it was, you know, it's funny because I think that Kirk realized, like, Kirk would break the rules, right? And Picard doesn't break the rules.
No.
But Picard is very much like, you know what? You're going to do what you're going to do. The mission is yours, Jameson. But you know what? Fuck you. I'm coming on the mission with you. And you're not going to stop me because I'm the captain.
Yeah.
And I liked that because it wasn't explicit. Like, Kirk would have made that kind of explicit. Picard's a lot more of a chess player than Kirk in some respects.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. He was just like, yeah, I'm going to go down. Stop me. What are you going to do?
And I like that Riker did, you know, kind of gives this very half second look like, I'm not even going to say, you know, this, you know what you're doing. And
I think that that's something that would not have been able to happen at the beginning of the season because they've been working together for a few months at this point.
We know that Riker guards his permission to, you know, Riker knows that the one thing he can override his captain on is whether or not he goes on a mission.
Yeah.
Whether or not he leaves the ship. We've seen it once or twice before where he said, you know, okay, no, I can't for this reason. And so I think he's learned that Picard is not going to just now say anything. You know, he's not just going to try every opportunity he can because he realizes, no, I'm probably not going to be given permission. He says it so decisively that I get the sense that if you know, Riker even opened his mouth, Picard would have court-martialed him right there. You know?
Yeah, no, I think Riker knows when to push and when to not push, and I think at that moment he knew not to push.
Picard, yeah, and Picard is very obviously an unstoppable force in that scene.
Yeah.
And then once they get onto the planet, I liked Karnas a lot because he comes off as this blustering, you know, he's a character for a while, and then once he finally clicks and realizes, oh no, this is that guy, he changes completely and he becomes a little human in a way, and I like
my
this.
My question about that was, and again, this may just be because the episode is extremely, you know, underwritten, but what didn't he meet Jameson 40 years ago? So yeah. Why wouldn't he have recognized him exactly?
Because he met him 40 years ago, and somebody who looks,
someone that he kept a really, really big grudge on for 40 years, like he wouldn't recognize him.
He thinks it's a charade. He sees somebody who looks exactly like he did 40 years ago, he's going to assume that there's a trick. He's, number one, remember, he had a conversation with the very old man version of him a few days prior to this. So that's who he's expecting to see. He's expecting to see someone who is aged 40 years. And he sees,
I don't know, that just
hasn't.
Seems like that just seems like a violation of Occam's razor to me. Like, come on, they're going to, like, what, clone him or like surgically alter someone to look like this guy for what reason?
Well, that's he does, you know, he doesn't know, but
I don't think that the script has an answer. I just think they needed to flesh it
put
out.
It this
they,
way.
They needed to run for five more minutes, and that was how they got it.
I mean, if you met a friend from high, if you were going to meet a friend from high school and he showed up looking exactly like he did at 17, you would be taken aback for a second. You'd be like, wait, what the fuck, you know?
And then I would have sex with him.
Well, that's disgusting. But as he's going on, like, his reactions become very complex. Like, he's... When he's saying, you know, the hostages are going to be...
That's kind of generous, but okay.
You know, the hostages are going to be freed, you know, immediately. Like, he's almost just like, I don't even know what's fucking happening. I'm done with this. I feel like I'm done, you know?
He's like, all right, guys, see you later.
Well, you know, I mean,
I'm going to the buffet now.
That's really the only proper reaction. Like, just, you can see him having savored this reaction, this revenge for 40 years. He has been waiting.
Yeah.
He has been waiting to shoot this guy, and... What he's, you know, what he sees happening to him is just so much more fucked up than that. That,
well,
I think he ends a little creeped out by what, you know, this entire situation. This was just a series of bad decisions that ruined a fucking planet.
I don't disagree. Yeah, I think he realizes the tragedy of the situation.
Again, this could have been a better episode. This episode could have been high tragedy, and I think I like the idea of that episode. It doesn't quite hit that mark.
Well, we haven't talked about the youth serum. And
do we have to?
I don't really know what that added to the show at all. Like, I get...
I mean, it's more... The sci-fi elements are more symbolic and thematic.
No,
and
I know. It's supposed to be, a symbol of his wanting to recapture his youth and blah, blah, blah. But
don't take any... Yeah. This is... I mean, we remember the episode of the animated series where everyone became babies.
Well, like, I actually thought about that. That was the counterclock incident, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know.
And they ended up, I mean, there are two different angles of it. The one, you know, counterclock incident ends with saying, well, you know, that part, you know, our youth is over and, you know, we cannot go back. But at the same time, you know, we have lived that life and we can't take back mistakes, but we can learn from them. We can move on from them. And that's how we grow. That's how we become, you know, better people. And this is kind of... It's not the same exact moral. This is a little more like, but both of them definitely are dealing with the theme that you can't take it back. You need to figure out how to resolve without trying to stay in this. I mean, it's not insignificant that the planet is in civil war because of cycles of revenge.
Yeah.
If, you know, if the Federation had just said no and not given them weapons and, you know, managed to... You know, if what he should have done was go on an away mission and try to do an action to rescue the hostages, because if, you know, if he'd been a better tactician and, you know, maybe that would have been the best thing. It would have avoided the civil war. It would have avoided the bloodshed. And, you know, what he's trying to do is replay this incident, of course.
So making him younger, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's impossible to do. You're not younger.
Right, because he still is the person that he has been for the past 45 years. He's 45 years older mentally, if not physically.
The correct thing to do would have been to cop to the mistake and to, you know, deal with the mistake in the proper way instead of trying to hide it, trying to lie about it.
But the youth serum does give the show the opportunity to have dramatic shadows on his face, which was just, wow, okay.
You know, it's not a great episode, but I think... And maybe this is another one of those, damn, it had a lot of potential that just didn't.
Two Civil Wars? Yeah.
I would give it 4 doses of youth serum.
All right. Well, next week, we are going to talk about When the Bow Breaks and Home Soil, neither of which I have any recollection of whatsoever, so it should be a good week.
I can't picture any of them being good.
We'll see you then.